Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Sam Tracy. This week, we're featuring a four-part series from the 2024 Summer Institute at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. Today's talk, the second in the series, is titled The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, and features author Tim Alberta in conversation with Professor R. Marie Griffith. Tim Alberta is an award-winning journalist and staff writer for The Atlantic. R. Marie Griffith is the John C. Danforth Distinguished Professor in the Humanities at Washington University in St. Louis, and served 12 years as the director of the John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics. The event was recorded live on July 30th, 2024. This episode, along with the rest of the series, will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org.
Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Marie.
As I noted just now, your book has had tremendous resonance with American audiences, although presumably not all American Christians. Why do you think it's hit such a chord with people? And who are the audiences that have been most likely to resonate with it, want to talk to you, as well as who are the audiences that have been resistant and critical of it?
Boy, I think probably part of the reason that it's resonated the way that it has is many of us who grew up in the evangelical subculture have sort of recognized that something is wrong, that something is fundamentally incompatible in this moment with. There's a scene early in the book where I'm talking with a professor at Liberty University, and he has sort of reached his wit's end. He is a legacy at Liberty. His parents were contemporaries of Jerry Falwell Sr. He grew up in Lynchburg. All he ever wanted was to go to Liberty, and then he did. And then all he wanted was to teach at Liberty, and he did. And now this professor is sort of surveying the wreckage and thinking about the damage that's been done. And he sort of says to me at one point, he says, you know, it wasn't supposed to be this way. And he says, you know, I can't help but think that the hardest thing for us to do is to challenge our parents, to challenge the previous generations on the things that may have gone wrong. And the really hard thing is to challenge them with the lessons that they taught us, right? And I think that I see some heads nodding, that can be one window into this world. You have entire generations now of younger believers and younger folks who grew up in the church who have drifted away from either their beliefs or the church, in many cases both, in part because of what they see as a sort of credibility gap. People who were taught to love your enemy, people who were taught to turn the other cheek, people who were taught that if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, that is a one-way ticket to oftentimes mistreatment, oppression, abuse, physical harm even. I mean, that is the story of the early church. That is the story of the Gospels. That is sort of part and parcel of the commitment one makes when declaring their faith in Jesus, is that none of this is going to be easy. In fact, Jesus promises you that it's not going to be easy. And I think for a lot of us who grew up with those lessons, internalizing all of that, to then see in recent years the ways in which the evangelical movement, pieces of it at least, have lashed out and have declared war on their enemies, using as justification this idea that, well, we're under siege here in America, right? Mm-hmm. Our status is being attacked. Our faith is being attacked. We're being mocked and belittled in the public square. God has been taken out of American life, and we need to fight back. And I think there is this glaring disconnect and this inconsistency that, again, for many of us who grew up steeped in scripture, who grew up, you know, like I write in the book about having been raised in the church, physically, literally raised in the church. I mean, I was there as much as I was at my home. And none of this is to say, I want to offer the caveat right up front that I'm sitting up here with a halo over my head, because I'm not. I promise you, I am as broken and depraved, as in need of grace as anyone. But I think there is at the core of this, Marie, a generational schism here. Mm-hmm. And I think for people in my generation, we now have this kind of critical distance from the moral majority, from what went wrong in that era, from this sort of this militant weaponizing of Christianity. And we can see it in our parents. We can see it in our churches that we grew up in, and we want nothing to do with it. And I think it has created a tremendous amount of angst and tension mm-hmm. and heartache in the church. And so what's been interesting in the feedback that I've gotten to the second point of your question is, I don't go a day without getting a couple of emails from people around my age, you know, anywhere from early 30s to early 40s, who are going through this exact same thing. But I'm also getting a lot of emails from their parents, from their parents' generation, who some of those notes have been a little bit hostile. That's to be expected. Some of them have been really interesting and really open-minded and have been solicitous and have said, okay, I can maybe see now what my kids are saying, and maybe this is a conversation that's long overdue. Mm-hmm. So it's been sort of a mix.
That's great. That's yeah. great. I think I told you I was raised Southern Baptist in roughly the same era you were, in an era when Jimmy Carter was a Southern Baptist, right? A very different. So yeah. I really identify with how you describe that sort of the evangelicalism of your youth, which I think is very similar to what I grew up with. Let's talk about Christian nationalism a little bit. A lot of ink is being spilled right now on Christian nationalism. And in the book, you write, champions of Christian nationalism would have you believe that their efforts to rule the country are inherently theological, that they are in service of a broader effort to reclaim America for God. This is a lie, end quote. How do you define Christian nationalism, and why do you think it's been so appealing to so many Americans?
Okay, this is a meatball right down the middle, and I'll try not to swing out of my shoes here in answering it. Because some of you, I'm sure most of you, have heard this phrase thrown around a lot, Christian nationalism. And the problem is that it means 10 different things to 10 different people, depending on who you're talking with. To me, I look at Christian nationalism as really the intersection of bad history and bad theology. And one is very much a prerequisite for the other. So here's what I mean by that. If you go back certainly 50, 60 years to the pre-moral majority era and the sort of the Jimmy Carter, and even in the sort of run-up in opposition to Jimmy Carter, right around the time in the late 60s, early 1970s, when all of these churches, conservative churches, some of them fundamentalists, some of them evangelical, all of them were starting to get a little worked up about the culture wars, right? And there's this moment where everybody feels like things are slipping away. Prayer is taken out of public schools. Pornography culture is rampant. The drug culture is rampant. Divorce rates are skyrocketing. Interracial marriage, Roe v. Wade, you name it, right? And there's this feeling that our country is slipping away. And so what you're starting to see back then is a pretty scaled up effort to begin launching alternative Christian academies, K-12, and then also alternative Christian universities. The idea being that this is the fault of the secular education system, that they have whitewashed the true history of this country, that we were in fact made to be a Christian nation. At the very least, we were shaped by, informed by Judeo-Christian values, and now all of that has been pushed aside, and the result of it is this godless, pagan, secular, humanist culture that has indoctrinated all of our children into hating us and hating the church and hating God. If that sounds familiar, that was happening 60 years ago. It's, of course, again happening now. And I think what you're seeing now is an even more explicit, and I would argue an even more shameless effort to go about doing what they're doing. And to be clear about what they're doing, it is quite literally rewriting history. So you are seeing a sustained effort around the country, in state legislatures and individual school districts, trying to rewrite history books to make clear that, in fact, we were conceived as a Christian nation, that the founders very much envisioned this being a nation ruled by Christians, and more specifically by Christian men, by European Christian men. And so, and there, this is a very well-funded, very well-organized effort. You have people like David Barton, who has a massive organization. He speaks around the country. You have Chad Connolly. You have a number of these figures who are going around right now, really in a kind of systematic, sophisticated way, making the case that the country has been taken from us because our true history has been subverted by the left. And we are going to remind these future generations of what our history is. So the problem with this is twofold, of course. Number one, that it's bad history. A lot of it is just completely inaccurate at a factual level. But I think the bigger problem is that this bad history then becomes the sort of the edifice upon which you can begin to build a bad theology. The bad history, if you believe it, if you believe that this country that was formed this specific way and that it has now been taken away from us and that we have to fight to get it back, part of the language that is being used here is language of a covenant, right? And it is running very much parallel to the Old Testament covenant with the nation of Israel. And this is not accidental, because the idea is that once you can convince all of these people, all of these church leaders, all of these Christian school teachers, all of these homeschoolers, all of these parents, once you can convince them of the bad history, then it becomes very easy to start distorting the theology and getting them to sort of rationalize and justify, ultimately, behavior that is antithetical to what one would find in sort of classic Reformed Orthodox Christian doctrine. And if you have conversations with these folks, as I do throughout the book, in trying to understand how is it that you are able and willing to stray so far from the rather unambiguous teachings of Christ, so often they will point to this and say, well, desperate times call for desperate measures. This nation was ordained by God, and an attack on this country is an attack on God himself. And so we are fighting to preserve this covenant nation. We are fighting to preserve this new Israel. So Christian nationalism in that context, I think, can almost be sympathized with to some degree, because if people truly believe that, then you can understand the level of panic that they're feeling. I think the problem is that the great majority of people I know who I've covered in this space, they don't believe it. They're counting on a lot of easy marks to believe it, but they themselves don't believe it. They're not after restoring a God-fearing America. They are after power. They are after influence. They are after control. And I would just offer as a brief conclusion to a long rambling definition there. There was this conference a couple of years ago called the National Conservatism Conference. And it gathered a number of luminaries from across the sort of right-wing intellectual academic activist space. And they signed at the end of it a declaration of principles for their movement. It's a pretty short list. You could read through it. And one of the bullet points, one of the subheadings, was on religion and public life. And this statement of principles said explicitly, very plainly, there was no winking and nodding involved here, said very clearly that in our vision of an America ruled by the tenets of national conservatism, they said that citizens would be protected from religious coercion by the state in their private homes and in their private lives. I'll repeat that. Citizens would be protected from religious coercion by the state in their private homes and in their private lives. But in public, they're fair game. The people who signed that document are a who's who of some of the most influential people in conservative movement politics today. These are people who would absolutely find themselves working in a second Trump administration. Some cases, people who would be in the West Wing. Some people who would probably be making regular stops in the Oval Office. So these are not fringe characters. And what they have put into writing is very clear, very plain, what they envision about what they want for this country. And so the danger with the Christian nationalist argument, and I worry about this in my field of journalism, I worry about it in the field of academia, is that the label is being thrown around so haphazardly that it can almost become counterproductive. You can offend people with it. You can antagonize people with it. And suddenly they start self-identifying and they want to charge into the fray because, well, they love this country and they love Christianity. So of course that makes them a Christian nationalist. But what I'm really describing here is something that is much more sinister and power hungry in its aims. And that is a threat. It's a very real threat, and not in the abstract, not in the long term. It is a threat here and now.
I'd like to ask you about the sort of more personal dimension of this. You know, one of the distinctive characteristics of your book are the amazing interviews that you do. And one interesting aspect, I think, that you found is, and this goes a little bit against, I think, what you just said, the ambivalence or uncertainty that a lot of evangelical pastors actually seem to feel internally about the political turn that they've taken. So I just want to read a short paragraph you wrote about Pastor Greg Locke from Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Locke has just told you in one sentence that he wouldn't take up arms against the government. And then he turns around and says, but if the liberals take away Christians' guns, then we'll meet them at the door with our Second Amendment right. And so you write this: this rhetorical turnabout, making clear in one gulp of air that he draws the line at violence, then suggesting in the next that his congregants would shoot anyone who tried to prevent the church from convening, was representative of our longer conversation. The pastor was surprisingly pensive and receptive to tough questioning. He would regularly admit to having taken something too far and lament how a stray soundbite that went viral had distracted from the substance of his sermon. Then he would double down on that same soundbite as if fearful that I took his contrition for cowardice. That's a remarkable paragraph. Tell us more about this. What's going on there?
So I think when the history books are written about this period, there will be a lot made of Donald Trump. There will be a lot made of racial resentment and grievance in this country. I think we have lived through an era of just intense radioactive polarization dating back to really the aftermath of 9/11. And I think we're still feeling it economically, culturally. I think in this specific context that you're asking about, Marie, I think the history books would do well to settle first and foremost on the question of what happened during COVID-19. The reason I say that is because for those of you who did not grow up in the evangelical church, didn't grow up listening to the televangelists or the radio evangelists, didn't grow up reading the kids' literature, this may sound very strange, very foreign to you. But some of you will know exactly what I'm talking about, which is to say that, you know, for many decades of my life, I was really marinating in this message coming from parts of the evangelical world that said, we are in a cosmic spiritual collision. We are heading for Armageddon in this country because the ascendant secular humanist progressive left that wants to shut down your churches, they want to eradicate the Almighty from public life, they have no tolerance for your religion, they hate you, they're coming. They are making a concerted effort to seize the levers of power in government and in other cultural institutions, and their goal is nothing less than total defeat of Christians in this country. And you had better be ready. You, Christian, had better be ready for that day when the rubber is going to meet the road. So the beginning of 2020, when churches around the country start to get notices from their pastor saying, hey, we don't know quite what's going on with this, but we're kind of following the latest guidance from state health departments, and we're going to play this safe and shut down the church for a week or two or three or a month or whatever, you know. That was the moment for a lot of these folks where they said, see, we knew this day would come. We knew this day would come when the government would shut down our church and they would use any excuse, any rationale to do it. And now it's here. It's here. They're telling us in America, the land of the free, they're telling us that we can't meet on Sunday because the government is deeming this virus, which some of us aren't even sure if it is a virus, that we can't meet and we can't worship our God together. This became the line in the sand, right? For pastors, for church leaders all around the country. And let me be clear here. The vast majority of my book is not focused on the main line of the Christian tradition, is not focused at all really on the progressive wing of American Christianity. I am talking about conservative, reformed, evangelical spaces where the pastors in these churches are themselves, by any definition, conservative, right? So for these pastors who had spent years, decades in some cases, building up this credibility with their congregations, for some of them to come out and tell them, we're going to stay at home for a couple of weeks, we're going to do virtual worship on Sunday morning, those pastors became apostates to their congregations. They became heretics. They became the shepherds who fled when the wolves were within earshot. And I cannot emphasize just how dramatic of a reshaping, a reshuffling that this has had on the church. In my travels all around the country, when I've talked with people, big churches, little churches, everything in between, I talk with hundreds of pastors, talk about George Floyd, talk about Donald Trump, talk about, you know, whatever, any number of different things, always comes back to COVID. COVID is where this distrust, and this is even setting aside some of the conspiracy theories that sort of then spawned out of COVID, but COVID was really the moment where a lot of longtime congregations, people who'd been worshiping together for 20 or 30 years, I mean, I've been in churches with people sobbing, telling me about how their small group met every Wednesday night for 30 years. And they were there crying and praying together after 9/11. They were there crying and praying together during the financial collapse. They were crying and praying together when somebody's kid had cancer and then died. That these people were family. And then within a couple of weeks, in the space of, you know, March and April of 2020, these people stopped talking to each other. And they stopped being a part of the same congregation together. They couldn't coexist anymore. So there are these fractures that have been driven into the heart of the church. And I'm sorry to say, I wish I had a happy conclusion to all of that doom and gloom, but we're still seeing it now. And I think it's going to be playing out for a very long time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Tim, okay, I want to put you on the spot just a little bit with this question. I absolutely love the book. When I was about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through, I wrote, and I was preparing my questions, I wrote down a question for me, for you, which was, why did you choose to interview only men? Now, fortunately, I continued reading because then you did interview some women. So Tiffany Thigpen, Jules Woodson, Julie Royes, and Rachel Den Hollander, to be precise, who come up, you get to them about page 367. So now what's interesting to me, a couple things here, is that these women are known as courageous advocates for sexual abuse reform in the churches, in the Southern Baptist Convention and other evangelical settings. They're survivors themselves. So I just wanted you to talk to me a little bit about your choice to interview them and what particular light they shed on contemporary evangelicalism. And then maybe you could say a word about why there aren't more women's voices in the book.
So would you believe me if I told you that it was intentional?
Okay, sure.
You don't have to, you can say no. Listen, it's no secret to anyone who's been a part of this world that the evangelical subculture is dominated by men. It can be very difficult to have these conversations. You know, I grew up in a very conservative church, and conservative on every possible or even theoretical issue that would come before the congregation, the default answer was go right. And that's just what it was. And yet, every Mother's Day, my father, who was in the pulpit for nearly 30 years as the senior pastor, every Mother's Day, my dad would invite my mom to give the sermon, who is a brilliant and amazing speaker in her own right, and someone who knows the gospel as well as anyone in the church. And there were, I didn't realize this until many years later, my mom told me this, that there were couples, families in the church who'd gone there with us forever, who were very close with us, who that Sunday, they would come in for the worship and the singing and the prayers, and then they would leave while my mom preached. And then they would come back in at the end for the prayers. And that's in a relatively progressive church on the matter of gender roles. Like my dad had written earlier in his career, had written an entire position paper on why he believes that women should serve as elders and as pastors in his church congregation. And he was raked over the coals for it by some of his friends and colleagues in other denominations. So it's a very difficult thing to appreciate just how sensitive this conversation is around the idea of complementarianism in the church, this idea that versus egalitarianism. So a complementarianism being that women are welcome, women are valuable, but you can't teach men. You can't be in a position to hold any sort of spiritual leadership, real or perceived, over men. Whereas you get egalitarians take a more, modern approach. This is a real fault line that runs through American Christianity in general, where there's a split on it. But in the evangelical world, it is not a split. It is like 90-10, right? And what I noticed in that all the churches I was visiting, all of the pastors I was speaking to, and I got a pretty good array, a pretty good diverse assortment of folks, when I would ask, hey, who should I talk to about this? Do you have a couple of lay leaders who I can speak with? Do you have some other people in the congregation that I might be able to talk with? Every single time, almost without fail, the pastors or the church leaders would say, yeah, talk to him, talk to him. It was never talk to her. And that became very apparent, very conspicuous as time went on. And so as I was thinking about the ways in which I might incorporate not just women's voices generically, but women's voices who would be able to speak to some of the ways that they've been mistreated, some of the ways that they've been silenced, some of the ways that they've been sort of classified as second-class Christians, I wanted to build to it. I wanted to get to a place in the book where, much as I did sort of similarly with young people, I wanted to mostly keep young people's voices out of it, because young people are another group that is sort of marginalized in the church. And really, they don't have a seat at the table often to push for the sort of reforms that they believe and that I believe would be healthy for the church in the long term. So I wanted readers to get a little antsy as they were going. I wanted readers to reach a point where, when those female, those incredible, brave female voices come bursting through the page, I wanted the maximum impact of it, because I think any church I'm a part of, including the one that my wife and I literally are a part of, any conversation I'm invited to with the pastors, with the elders, I will make the case not to be woke, not to be PC, not to be whatever. I will just say the healthiest Christian environments I have been in, places where people grow, where they thrive, where they are sanctified, where they really can become more like Christ, those are places that feature prominent women in leadership, and where they also elevate young people to have a seat at that table. So I think that it was important for me to try to deliver a jolt in that way.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, I want us to sort of shift and get closer back into some of the connections to Trump here. About midway through the book, you cite a very powerful quote from Russell Moore, who is the one-time Southern Baptist leader who was drummed out of the denomination, even though he's actually extremely conservative. But he was drummed out for his opposition to Trump. And at one point in your interview with him, one of your interviews, he says, when your idols begin to disappoint you, it can lead you back to God. Hmm. That's page 211. And then on the other hand, that pastor I cited a minute ago, Greg Locke, he told you about talking politics in church. I don't think there's any going back. That train has left the station. This is who we are. So I just wanted to ask you, do you think Christians will become disappointed, disillusioned with Trumpism? Or do you sort of agree with Locke that this is really what much of most of evangelical Christianity looks like now and will continue to look like?
Oh, boy. I have a couple of answers, and they're not necessarily in conflict with one another. I think the first thing I would point out is that in 2016, when Donald Trump became the Republican nominee, his weakest cell of support in trying to assemble the Republican coalition to come together to win, his weakest segment of support was among self-identified white evangelicals. They were the people who had voted for Ted Cruz. They were the people who had voted for Jeb Bush, for Marco Rubio, for John Kasich. They were very leery of Trump, and with good reason, right? We don't need to go through the greatest hits of Donald Trump. And Trump knew it. And Trump had a couple of people whispering in his ear who gave him some really shrewd advice. And they said, look, a couple of things we can do. Number one, put out a list of Supreme Court justices and make sure that you are putting forth a roster of the most staunchly pro-life people that you can find to put that we could have on the bench one day if you're elected. So he did that. Trump also went to New York City and he met with this massive ballroom full of evangelical leaders, highly influential people, Franklin Graham, Jerry Falwell Jr., who immediately after this event went to Trump Tower, posed for a picture with Trump, thumbs up, with a Playboy magazine cover behind them on the wall, which was, folks, you don't get this sort of irony very often. I mean, you just have to savor it when you get it. And the interesting thing is that Trump in that meeting was introduced by these evangelical figureheads, and they were vouching for him, saying, you know, God throughout scripture uses imperfect vessels for his own perfect plan. And they could point to Moses, they could point to King David, they could point to Solomon, they could point to King Cyrus of Persia. And I'll come back to this point in a minute because it's very important, I think. But really, the big one for Trump that helped clinch the support he needed to get across the finish line and to beat Hillary Clinton was picking Mike Pence as his vice presidential nominee. And the combination of these things was a very explicit. Trump even said it at one point in one of the debates. He said, I will only put pro-life justices on the court, right? So Trump was able to get across the finish line and very narrowly defeat Hillary Clinton. I mean, Trump wins the election in 2016 by a combined 77,744 votes spread across three states, right? And if you look at the exit polling, if you parse out all of the after-election analytics that were done, it was the single issue pro-life evangelicals in those states that absolutely put Trump across the finish line. So they won him the election. But they won him the election holding their nose. I mean, I talked to people who said to me literally that they stepped in the ballot booth, checked the box for Trump, left the ballot booth, and prayed for forgiveness, right? That's how a lot of folks felt. What's so interesting is that over the next 4 years, these people went from Trump's softest supporters to his most fervent supporters, right? And you ask, why? Why? You could understand it in 2016. There's Supreme Court vacancy hanging in the balance. This is a guy who, you know, for whatever his warts, at least we know what we're going to get with Hillary and it's going to be bad with him. Maybe we'll get some good policy. And let's be clear, folks, he did give social conservatives some good policy. He did put conservative jurists on the court. He did deliver some things that he would promise to them. And yet, when you go back and talk to people late in his presidency, after he lies about losing the election, after he incites the riot on January 6th, and then he's running again, and you ask these same people, why are you supporting him? Like, you got what you needed out of him, but now you've got other options. You've got Nikki Haley, you've got Tim Scott, you've got all these other options. You have an off-ramp now. You don't need to support this guy anymore. And what came up in those conversations was, I think, the fundamental theme that I come back to time and time and time again in the book, which is that these people perceive Christian America to be slipping out of their grasp. They perceive that their way of life is approaching extinction. They perceive the barbarians to be at the gates coming for them. And they have all looked around and decided, you know what? Maybe we need a barbarian to protect us. And that, in a nutshell, is the relationship with Donald Trump. It is almost a mercenary type relationship where a lot of these people, you'll spend an hour in conversation with them and they will not say a single redeeming thing about the man. They will point to his language. They will point to his extracurricular activities and his marriages. They will point to all of these things. And then you get to the end and they say, yeah, but he's going to protect us. He's going to fight for us. He's going to do the things for us that no good, pious, church-going Christian would ever do to protect us. And I think that that's a fascinating insight into the sort of transactionalism that has informed this relationship from the start. But of course, you ask yourself, at what point, if ever, would they say, can't do it anymore, enough is enough? Because every time we thought that we were getting to that point, it sort of slipped away from us. And if anything, there was a really interesting moment. It's a long answer, but real quickly, I'll add. In the aftermath of the 2022 midterms, you may have seen this, but Trump threw the pro-lifers under the bus. He said it was their fault that Republicans lost all these winnable races. And for about 4 weeks after that, Trump's numbers, for the first time in the last 7 years, they started going down with evangelical Christians, like considerably down. And that's where people like Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley and others saw a real opening. And then do you know what happened? Alvin Bragg's indictment landed in New York, and his numbers that had been going down with evangelicals went right back up. Because it played perfectly into this sense of a persecution complex, right? That they're coming for us, and they've got to get through him first because he's the one protecting us. And so now Trump is almost, he's almost supernaturally insulated from any critique, any criticism, any attack. Anything the guy does can almost be turned around into a, from a negative into a positive, because folks think, well, that's just the rough and tumble nature of the guy, and that's why he's so effective in protecting us.
Wow. Yeah. Well, let's talk about his current pick for VP, because you've continued writing. This is getting us beyond the book a little bit. But most recently, I think your Atlantic piece that was published last week called "This Is Exactly What the Trump Team Feared." And in that piece, you wrote that campaign officials acknowledged to you that Trump's selection of J.D. Vance as the running mate was something of a luxury meant to run up margins with the base in a blowout rather than persuade swing voters in a nail biter. And I think you were one of the first, you may have been the first journalist to report the Trump campaign's second guessing of the Vance pick, a selection that you tweeted was born of cockiness that no longer seems warranted. So I'm just curious what you expect to happen now and what the implications really are for evangelicals and other potential Trump voters, even beyond the evangelicals.
Yeah. So the first part about Vance, I mean, it's really interesting. The Trump campaign for many months had been operating on parallel tracks where they were thinking with a couple of different theories about what he might want to do. On the one track, it was, listen, you pick a boring, vanilla, non-controversial caretaker type who's just going to stand and salute and do what you tell him to do. And he's not going to ever threaten you or steal the limelight from you, kind of like the way that Mike Pence was up until January 6th. Small falling out, if you may have heard after that. And Trump was really leaning in that direction for a long time. The other argument on the parallel track was, listen, you're getting old. You've created this movement, the likes of which the Republican Party has really never seen, at least not since Reagan, but arguably way past Reagan. And maybe you need to pick an heir apparent. Maybe you need to put your finger on the scales here. And instead of waiting for this to play out after you leave office, you make your call now based on who you think is best positioned to carry the MAGA mantle moving forward. The interesting thing is that for much of the Trump campaign, as they were deliberating on this, they were pretty squarely on that first track. Only in about the past month, or only in about the month leading up to his actual selection, did Trump start to veer towards that second track. And a big part of this was the cockiness. It was the arrogance that they felt like, listen, we are running away with this campaign. And to be clear, they were running away with this campaign. All of the modeling, all of the polling, down to township precinct levels that you were seeing from Democrats in battleground states, it was abysmal. They were not going to be able to overcome Biden at the top of the ticket. It wasn't just Biden going to lose. Democrats were going to get slaughtered down the ticket. This was going to be very, very bad. And they knew it. The Trump people knew it. And I wrote about this in some great detail because I'd spent many months inside the campaign. What's so interesting is that Trump, I think that arrogance, that hubris really started to bleed into his decision-making. And ultimately they chose a guy who is 39 years old, who's had no taste whatsoever of the scrutiny, the white hot spotlight of a national campaign, a guy who's got a history of saying some pretty weird and cringeworthy things, and ultimately a guy who, at the end of the day, adds nothing to the Trump coalition. In other words, if you believe that politics is all about addition and multiplication and not about subtraction and division, you're looking at where the vulnerabilities are for a Republican ticket led by Donald Trump, and you're looking at suburban college-educated women who think he's a creep. And you're looking at certainly even some of these reluctant pro-life voters, single-issue evangelical voters who they held their nose in 16, maybe they even held it again in 20, but they can't do it again in 24. J.D. Vance really doesn't do anything to address those weaknesses. He sort of doubles down on the core strength of the pugilistic populism of Donald Trump. So yes, there is a lot of second guessing, a lot of buyer's remorse at this point. I don't think, just to answer the question that I know is popping up in everyone's thought bubble, I don't think that he's going to ditch him, because even at a mechanical level, it's very hard now. He formally accepted the nomination at the party's convention. It would be a mess to try and untangle all of that. And then to the second question quickly that you asked, Marie, because it ties into the point I was making about the single issue evangelical voters. I have been stunned as a political journalist, as someone who reads everything that anybody writes on the subject here. I've really been stunned that there hasn't been more attention paid to the fact that this is America's first post Roe v. Wade presidential election. For 50 years, activists on both sides of the aisle, but particularly pro-life activists, have been told, listen, if you care about the issue of abortion, then you have to vote in a presidential year. Because you're not voting for a president, you're voting for Supreme Court justices. And Supreme Court justices are the ones who will ultimately decide abortion law in America. So for 50 years, you see this in the exit polling, you see this in the social science. A huge number of self-identified single-issue evangelical voters who are pro-lifers have come out and reliably voted Republican, even though they think in many cases that the Democratic platform on social justice, on caring for the poor, that the Democratic platform may actually be a better fit for them, but they are deeply invested and sincerely convicted about the abortion issue, right? So now it's taken off the table. Republicans are going around the country saying, hey, it's defederalized. It's thrown back to the states. You don't have to worry about it now in a presidential election. And I think that this is hugely problematic for Republicans. I think that there is a very real chance that even if you're looking at the margins, I said earlier that 2016 was decided by 77,744 votes. Guys, 2020 was decided by 42,910 votes spread across three states. I mean, these are microscopic margins. So if you're even talking about a fractional number, 1.5, 2% of these single issue pro-life voters deciding to stay home or vote third party or leave the top of the ticket blank, that could create an enormous problem for Trump. And I don't think that they have really thought about how they're going to address it.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to ask you one more very quick question. I'll ask you to respond briefly, and then we're going to open it up. I can't really see very well here, but I know Sean will be somewhere. Okay, just last question quickly. What do you see as the political implications for democracy, the theme of our Summer Institute this week, if Trump is elected and brings more Christian nationalist types into his administration?
Well, okay, let me give you a... I even struggle to give you the worst case scenario because people are going to need fainting couches to fall over on. And frankly, I don't think the worst case scenario is realistic. Look, I have spent time with the former president. I've sat in the Oval Office with him. I've spent a lot of time with his campaigns. I know people who are very close to him. I don't think Trump, there are reasons to worry about a Trump presidency. I don't think Trump trying to transform America into a theocracy is one of them. I just don't. Now, do I think that there will be people around him who are self-identified Christian nationalists who will try to do everything they can to sort of slip things past him or to coax him into, you know, hey, this is just a symbolic gesture? For example, there has been talk in the highest levels of the conservative movement, people who have Trump's ear, about a symbolic declaration of Christianity as America's state religion, right? Now, that may sound sort of toothless to some, I'm guessing based on the reactions I'm seeing here, not to you, because last I checked, the Establishment Clause of the Constitution says that there will be no establishment of a state religion. The First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees a freedom of religion and a freedom from religion, from religious coercion. So yes, there is a danger that there will be, I think, in a more unilateral and symbolic way, a push to do some things that could be fundamentally undemocratic and, to be clear, fundamentally unchristian, right? Now, And I say that, I say that, if I can elaborate for a quick moment. I know my answers go long. I'm glad my wife's not here rolling her eyes at me in the back. At least I don't think she is. When I say fundamentally unchristian, folks, I just can't drive this point home enough. I don't know how many of you are believers in the room. If I can take a backdoor to proselytizing you for just a moment, it is really important to understand that in the first 3.5 centuries of the church, in the earliest moments from the resurrection of Christ, the people who went around proclaiming his gospel, the people who went around saying to anybody who would listen, that, listen, this rabbi who we've been following for 3.5 years and who we watched nailed to a Roman tree and die in front of all of us, and then we watched him buried, and then we went into hiding because we thought that we were next, and now they've burst out of hiding and they're running around telling anybody who will listen that he's alive. We've seen him. He's risen. And they've also done these very strange things. They've started, after centuries of their people, the Jewish people, not having anything to do with Gentiles, suddenly they're calling them brothers and sisters and worshiping with them. After worshiping on Saturdays for centuries, now they're worshiping on Sundays. After not eating pork and other foods for centuries, suddenly they're eating whatever they want. An entire paradigm shift has occurred here. And everybody's trying to understand what happened, right? And in those first 3.5 centuries, these early followers of Jesus were rounded up, beaten, fed to lions, crucified, burned alive, used literally as human candles in Emperor Nero's court, right? And do you know what they did when they were locked in prisons? Do you know what they did when they were being taken away to be killed? They sang hymns and they prayed for the people who were persecuting them. My favorite character in the New Testament is Peter, who is sort of Jesus's best buddy and right-hand man, the guy Jesus said that they were going to build the church on the rock of Peter, right? On the night of Jesus's arrest, Peter pulls out a sword and lops off the ear of one of the guys arresting him. And Jesus heals the man's ear and says, Peter, no, dude, no. You're not with the program here, buddy. Like, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. That same Peter, not long after, is writing from a Roman prison, and he's awaiting his own execution. And what is he writing? He's writing an epistle explaining to everyone who is being oppressed and being martyred, rounded up for their faith in Jesus in the early church, all around the ancient Near East. He's writing this letter telling them, listen, remember, you will be judged by the grace and the love that you show to your tormentors. You will be judged by your ability to show grace and to show kindness and compassion to these people who are treating you so horribly. What could have possibly changed for this man to go from the sword in that way to suddenly the cross? The reason that the Christian nationalist argument falls apart, the reason that what some of these people want to do if given the opportunity would fall apart, is because it's not just un-American, it is fundamentally anti-Christian. Christianity has, since the first century, thrived at the margins. It has thrived in being countercultural. Only when Constantine tried to take control in the fourth century and turn it into state religion, that was the beginning of all of our problems. Because Christians suddenly believed that when they were in trouble, they could run to the strong man. They could run to the sword. They could run to the political ruler who promised to protect them. Sound familiar? Right? And so we've been fighting this now for 17 centuries since. And what you see throughout the whole arc of history, there's a phenomenal book by a professor at Wheaton named John Dixon, and he writes a book called Bullies and Saints, and it tracks 2,000 years of how Christians have responded to times of persecution and oppression and martyrdom. And if you look, the times when Christians have turned to the sword is the times at which Christianity has completely lost its credibility in the wider culture. People here tonight who are not Christians, I'm sure if I got to talking with you, you would probably say, in part, the reason you want nothing to do with Christianity is because you want nothing to do with the church. You want nothing to do with these Christians, these so-called Christians who seem to be so bent on subjugating you and dominating the culture and hating their enemy instead of loving their enemy. But if you were just to shift the paradigm and go back to the earliest church teachings around what it meant to be a Christian, these people back then could never have conceived of controlling a nation. They never could have conceived. Jesus in the wilderness was tempted, given all the kingdoms of the world, and he told Satan, get behind me. When there's a passage in Mark where the crowds are descending on him to make him king. These Jews who are under a brutal and dehumanizing Roman occupation, and they want to make him king, and he flees. He doesn't want to be king. He doesn't want to be Caesar. And he didn't want his followers to pick up swords and go fight the Romans. He was preaching an entirely different program. But we in the American context have become so coddled and so comfortable and so entitled to believe that we are owed these rights, that we are owed a Christian nation, that we are somehow, that it is our birthright. We have completely lost touch with the Christians, our brothers and sisters all around the world today who are being persecuted for their faith, and all of our ancestors who come before us who could have never conceived of this idea that we need to use Christianity as a means to dominate the world around us. And I just hope that people can understand what Christianity really is relative to what some of these folks would want you to believe it is.
Okay, so we're gonna open it up.
Hey, Tim, thanks for being here. I'm sort of wondering, in the past 8-9 years, there's been a few different strategies employed to sort of combat Trump. Like, he was a con man and vulgar. And then after January 6th, it was, he's a threat to democracy. Very recently, post picking J.D. Vance, even you said it, a lot of people are calling him just weird. And that's sort of the strategy right now. I'm wondering if you think that strategy is going to be effective, or what strategy might be, particularly for like the evangelical community.
Boy, that's a really good question. So, okay, on the weird thing specifically, I'll just say, I'm not sure how effective it will be. I've got to think that there's sort of a diminishing return, because some of the same, I've had this conversation with Democratic operatives and with Republican operatives. Some of these same suburban moderate women outside the suburbs of Detroit and Milwaukee and Philly and Phoenix and Atlanta and Vegas, where the election's going to be decided in those areas, right? Those women do think Trump and Vance are weird on some of their policies. There's polling that shows they also think Democrats are really weird about boys and girls sports. They also think that Democrats are really weird that they covered up in a weekend at Bernie's operation for Joe Biden over the last couple of years. They think that the administration is weird that they chose to basically let the border stay open for 2.5 years before there was such an outcry, bipartisan outcry, that they finally did something about it. I don't know that weird is the terrain you want to fight on, because I think a lot of these voters in the middle of the electorate are pretty well convinced that both of these parties are weird. And I'm not sure that that's uniquely effective against Donald Trump. What is uniquely effective against Donald Trump, and we're going to see just how many eggs Democrats ultimately put in this basket, is the fact that he sabotaged the peaceful transition of power after he lost a free and fair election. The fact that he surrounded himself with crackpot attorneys who were coming up with extra legal and extra judicial and extra constitutional remedies to keep him in office. I think that in that sense alone, never mind his record in the preceding 4 years, I think in that alone, he stands apart in American history. And voters, I think, have been somewhat desensitized to it. It's been a while since January 6th. But I think what we saw in 2022 in the midterms is that the Democrats who really invested heavily in that message of not just democracy as an abstract idea, but that this guy cares more about himself than he does about the country. He cares more about himself than he does about your children. He cares more about himself than he does the sort of core democratic institutions of this country. I think that has shown some glimmers of being really effective for Democrats. But Republicans are loaded for bear. I'm just going to say this. I mean, people need to be realistic about what you're going to see over the next 3.5 months. Kamala Harris has quite a bit of baggage of her own, namely the things that she's inherited from Biden, being his vice president, historic inflation, the border a mess, Afghanistan withdrawal, geopolitical turmoil around the world. They are going to beat her up in ways that, I mean, I've seen some of what they're planning, and it's not pretty. So this is going to be trench warfare all the way to November. But if you're a Democrat, the good news is that you actually have a chance to win this election, and you didn't a week ago.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's conversation between Tim Alberta and R. Marie Griffith was recorded live at the College of the Atlantic's 2024 Summer Institute. This is the second part of a four-part series from the College of the Atlantic. On tomorrow's program, Joe Scarborough and William C. Eco will discuss challenges to democracy, media, misinformation, and the rise of authoritarianism. You can find this program and the rest of the series on our website, mainepublic.org. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, which is produced by me, Sam Tracy. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.